Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Frank Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago, and he later served as station manager and one of the co-hosts of the WGTD morning show. I have in hand a really entertaining and interesting book called You're Welcome, Cleveland, How I Helped LeBron James Win a Championship and Save a City. That intriguing title refers, of course, to the Cleveland Cavaliers of the NBA and to a certain player by the name of LeBron James, who for a while played for Cleveland, then left in a much-discussed exit to Miami Heat, where he went in search of success that had eluded him with the Cavaliers, and then, of course, very dramatically returned to Cleveland, in a sense returned home, and helped lead the Cavaliers to a world championship, a much needed, long-awaited, much-longed-for experience at the pinnacle of the sport. And Scott Robb has quite an interesting relationship with Cleveland and with LeBron James. As a matter of fact, Scott Robb is well known for his previous book, The Whore of Akron, which refers to none other than LeBron James and to his exit from Cleveland for Miami. So he's back with a new book that is, as I said, quite interesting and entertaining, published by HarperCollins, again called You're Welcome, Cleveland, How I Helped LeBron James Win a Championship and Save a City. Scott Robb, we welcome you to the morning show.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I really enjoyed this book quite a lot. Let's get a little context in place. At one point in the book, you say, I'd been a thuggish fan since my mid-teens.
it's true.
So tell us more about that, about how that is an apt description about the kind of sports fan that you have always been.
As a kid growing up in Cleveland, as an unhappy kid growing up in Cleveland, as kind of a miserable kid growing up in Cleveland who knew at an early age that writing was kind of the only thing that interested me besides Cleveland sports teams, I'm an old guy now. I'll be 65. The Cleveland I grew up in was a thriving major American metropolis, and as the city decayed, the teams as well, failed year in and year out. And I was the kind of guy who, in my late teens and early 20s, would show up at a lot of Cleveland Indians games, not well attended, a team with a history of year after year mediocrity. And I was the guy, luckily the stadium was empty, who would act out in a surly and drunken manner. I wasn't a soccer hooligan. I wasn't violent, except one time in Comiskey Park in Chicago that we don't need to talk about. but as the years went by and I went on with my life and tried to get some traction in a career as a writer, and moved from Cleveland, those teams remained at the center of my passion and obsession. And like with a lot of things, but especially with sports, you sublimate a whole lot of stuff in there, and then here comes the greatest athlete Northeast Ohio has ever produced, LeBron James. I think I'm 32 years older than LeBron, literally twice his age, but I'm attached and obsessed to this guy because he wound up with a Cleveland team, and finally I can see that perhaps I will live long enough to see a Cleveland team. I mean, I did see the Cleveland Browns win a championship in 1964 when I was 12. But with LeBron came the hope that I might see it again. And then I was a dad by that time. I became a dad, close to 50 years old. I realized, this could happen, and then he left. So I wrote The Whore of Akron after he left in 2010 out of a profound, personal, totally insane sense of betrayal. And then he came back almost as a Moses figure, returned to the city, talked about having a calling beyond basketball. And indeed, after one failure against Golden State in the 2015 finals last year, for the first time in over half a century, Cleveland team led by LeBron won a championship. I got to be in Cleveland, not at the game, which was in California, but in Cleveland, with other Cleveland fans and my son on Father's Day. That was my whole bucket list, Greg. So that's really the book. The book, in terms of a sports book where you really find out, the locker room secrets, it's really not that kind of book. It's kind of a crazed, I hope really funny, I hope, fans memoir.
It's a terrific book, and of course it's a whole lot about LeBron James and the Cavaliers and their coach and LeBron's teammates and so on. It's also an intensely personal book. I think you've already kind of alluded to that, but in particular, it is a book that talks a whole lot about fathering. It talks a lot about the way in which you were fathered, and the way that you have fathered your beloved son Judah. I wonder if you could just say a word about whether or not that was your intent, that was that your design right from the start when you first sat down in front of the word processor. Did you expect this book to be as much about that as it turned out to be?
Because I'm not the kind of dad who hunts or fishes or goes camping. I'm not the guy with the basement workshop or the guy who changes the oil or the plugs. I'm a writer, and for many years wrote full-time for Esquire magazine. The father-son thread with me and the kid really did center on sports. I mean, the relationship, it to me, feels very rich beyond that, but in terms of activities, we were road tripping, from a very early age. I would take him on road trips to Cleveland to see his first major league baseball game, to see the Cavaliers play. If a Cleveland team ever made the playoffs, which was rare, my wife's son and I would go to the game. So I didn't have this book, sketched out in my head. I don't come from the journalism background. I come from more of the MFA writer's workshop type background. So I always want to go deep. I always want to connect, my love for sports and even my kind of vision of LeBron as a young African American guy who I have kind of judged and found lacking. I want to write, out of some sense, how do these things connect? What is manhood? What is hero worship? And what gives meaning to my relationship with my son, which I did not have one, did really grew up without my dad. How do I figure this out, and what will bind us? And of course, sports serves to bind a whole lot of families, a whole lot of friends over the course of a lifetime. But as a writer, as a guy who tries to spend time, thinking and feeling and all that at the keyboard, what came out really was kind of a combination of an on the road, that kind of picaresque kind of narrative, and I think wound up feeling anchored in exactly what it felt like. Is this isn't forced, this isn't contrived. I'm not the great Santini competing against my son one-on-one on a basketball court. This is something that bonds us in a way that contains, all the love and all the kind of legacy, emotional legacy that a dad can share. So to the extent the book, turned out to reflect that, I'm really happy about that. To grow up as a passionate sports fan, come to fatherhood late, and be able to actually write about it, that's quite a blessing.
And I'm so glad that the book is so much about that. It's part of what makes the book truly unique and very much in your own voice. Towards that end, in terms of what we were just talking about, one very intriguing thing you write about the experience of sharing this thrilling Cleveland Cavaliers World Championship with your son Judah is that you wanted your son to see you cry with happiness. Explain why that was so important.
Well, I've been, anyone who can put together a career as a writer is forget about talent and hard work. That's a given. We all have to do that to get, but luck is a huge factor. So most of the times I've cried, we have not been faced as parents with some of the the tough facts and choices that parents have to make in terms of our kids' health. I mean, we've been blessed. So most of the time that my son has seen me cry, and I'm a frequent crier for an alpha male or a big bear type of guy. You know, I do cry a lot, but the Cleveland thing has been so frustrating. You know, it's one thing when you see your kid do something on the baseball field and you tear up. You know, that's great. That's every father is entitled to those manly tears that don't quite turn to weeping. But when my kid has seen me, sobbing with frustration at another hideous last-minute Cleveland sports team defeat, I also wanted him to experience the fans' feelings, if you're really crazy about a team, of winning it all. It's one of those rare situations in life where the results are final, and no one can take it away, and there's no arguing, there's no debating, there is a scoreboard. And, again, the feeling of having waited 50-plus years to see a Cleveland team win and worrying that my kid and I would never experience it. Now, that's hardly the worst tragedy to befall a family, but it really meant a lot. I mean, it's a measure of my own nuttiness that it meant so much to me, but I wanted the kid to see me happy about a Cleveland team.
We're speaking with Scott Robb about his newest book, You're Welcome, Cleveland, How I Helped LeBron James Win a Championship and Save a City. I think most of our listeners are well acquainted with the story of LeBron James growing so frustrated in Cleveland with the Cavaliers that he made a much ballyhooed exit from Cleveland for the Miami Heat in search of greater success. And in the wake of that exit, you wrote this book, maybe infamous book is a good word for it, called The Whore of Akron. I wonder if you could just, that's the only question I'm going to ask you about that previous book, but I wonder how serious and authentic was that book? I mean, was there any element of artifice or intended sort of theatricality in terms of the tone and tenor of that book? Or in many respects, was that a very authentic venting of the anger and hurt and betrayal that you felt for whatever reason at that point in time?
This, by the way, may be the best question I've ever been asked. everyone says, hey, that's a good question. No, this is a great question because, and this is going to sound maybe a little grandiose, maybe even delusional, but this is, part of being a writer, not a journalist, not a beat writer, and that's not, I love those guys, friends with those guys, respect what they do. But I have it both ways, at least in my mind. Even the title, The Whore of Akron, for me, because I come out of this more literary background, was a reference to the Whore of Babylon in the Book of Revelations, and the Apocalypse was also a reference to a lesser-known Woody Allen short story called The Whore of Mensa, and it was also in some ways, an exaggerated, the title really commercially was a terrible idea. It meant that some of the stores like Costco that have stacks of books and sell a ton of books, they're not going to stock that book so that, family shopping can walk by and see the word whore. So part of it was a genuine and I think organic, authentic expression of every Cleveland fan. Not that I speak for anyone but myself, but that sense of personal betrayal, treachery. And that's real, and yet I'm aware because, you're a writer, you really do think about this stuff, of how clownish that is, kind of how crazy and really hyperbolic, just to feel that way, have a sports team or an athlete making a decision based on what he thinks is best for his career and his family, to take that kind of umbrage, that's crazy.
Right.
So it really is both. Yeah, it's wildly exaggerated. It's kind of nuts, even to call a book that when you're talking about. And I came to terms with this in the new book, You're Welcome, Cleveland, is that, I'm a little ashamed. not that anyone should care. It didn't hurt LeBron's career. But, the first book was authentic, but also I think I was aware of how far I was going.
Right.
And how nuts it was.
Right. Well, and maybe it's a close picture of maybe kind of the duality of a lot of sports fans that in the moment, you might – something happens and you leap to your feet and you scream, it's the greatest moment of my life. And then in quieter retrospect, you realize that wasn't the greatest moment of my life, but in the moment, it felt like the greatest moment of my life. Greater than the birth of my kids, greater than my marriage, greater than anything else. And maybe that's part of what some of this sports stuff does to people. There is this wild sense of its exaggerated importance in the moment. But that's worth talking about, even if in the retrospect of the next day, we see it more clearly.
I think it's vital to talk about it in some ways, and in a larger sense, but it totally related, derives from that. You know, some of the social issues, and I really bumped up against those in the new book, because as LeBron's consciousness grew, when he was with the Heat, he and his Miami teammates donned hoodies after Trayvon Martin's murder, or killing, or whatever. Well, I mean, I really needed to engage this time around, if I was going to bother to do something that also felt authentic, with some of the issues. You know, the last couple of years have been really interesting, and in some ways, for an older American, jarring. Nobody needs to be further polarized, but I wanted to try and understand what we're looking at when we look at the NBA as an expression of African American culture, and on just a personal level, what in my response to LeBron James and the arc of his career, which I have taken so personally, how can I at least productively, fruitfully, and in a genuine way, you know, come to terms with my filters, I'm a Jewish guy of a certain age and a certain background, and I am obsessed with this African young guy from West Akron who's writing a great, almost biblical narrative, with his career. What's up with that? Hmm. So I tried to wrestle with that as well.
Right. One thing that, of course, was so interesting about LeBron James's return was that because of that previous book, one would guess, you were denied press credentials that you had been given in the past. I wonder if you could just say a word. I mean, and you write about it so tellingly, what it was like to feel, in a sense, like an outsider, at least in one respect, at this really important moment in the sports life of your city of Cleveland.
I think it was appropriate both for the team, with LeBron having come back and people being aware of the first book, the Horror of Akron, but also in terms of, I want to say, right-sizing, you know, just me as a human being and as a guy whose attachment to sports or to LeBron isn't for profit. It's an organic part of my life and at the center of my relationship with my son in a lot of ways. I think it was okay to remind me that I'm not writing these things because I'm a credentialed. I was credentialed for a couple seasons by the Cavaliers when I was writing the first book, and when LeBron came back and they denied me credentials on media day, I was supportive of their decision. I understood at this point I am peripheral. I exaggerated in the new book and call myself a pariah. You know, it's again that for me that's for humor's sake. But the truth of the matter is, I'm another guy with his face pressed up against the glass looking at these superheroes and feeling my feelings. The idea of being denied the kind of access that would just involve the normal, hey, the game's over, we get 15 minutes in the locker room, we all record the same quote to put into our game stories, that was never what it was about for me. Hmm. And in this sense, anyway, as a guy who, you know, rented a place back in my hometown and saw, you know, some of the gap between the writer guy who's writing for Esquire magazine and living in the New York City area and the Cleveland fan that I was and that I like to think I still am, that's a big gap too. For me, it was better not to have the access. It was just better.
Hmm. Can you explain something that you say about an essay that appeared in Sports Illustrated on the occasion of LeBron James's return to Cleveland? Mm-hmm. You said that essay broke you like a wafer. Can you just say a quick word about what it was about what he said or how he said it that was so powerful to you?
The you know, I left Cleveland. I get a little choked up about this stuff. I left that town to go to writing school, you know, graduate school. I always thought I would come back. So I realized with the letter that Lee Jenkins is the name of the Sports Illustrated writer. He worked on the letter with LeBron. It hit all the notes that I had felt my whole life. I'll get back there someday. Meanwhile, I haven't let go. You know, I'm still involved with Cleveland State, my alma mater, on a very, you know, small scale. I came to see with that letter that all that stuff. Look, everyone's from somewhere, and some of the truths in that little essay are true for all of us, no matter where we're from. But it spoke that whole idea of everything is earned, nothing is given,
particularly in Ohio.
Yeah, well, that's what it spoke to that resonated so strongly. You know, I made my way in the world and always felt Cleveland had given me more than I could ever repay, not in terms of confidence so much as, that kind of what the heck do I have to lose? If I'm going to go interview Taylor Swift, Donald Trump, or whatever, I'm still selling shoes at Cedar and Lee in Cleveland Heights. That taught me all I needed to know. So it's a little gooey and a little sentimental, but that kind of essay, you know, from again, the greatest athlete and a guy announcing he was coming home to Northeast Ohio, and I think he's funded over 1,000 scholarship, college tuition scholarships for third graders with a support system to help them get to college. I mean, that's walking the walk in every sense of the word, and I found that kind of thing, it just lit me up. It broke me in the best possible sense, you know, kind of brought me to my spiritual knees. Again, it sounds way overstated, but it felt that way to me that he's coming back. I should have tweaked the title of the first book, but by God, there's an example. You know, I'm 64, and that's a role model, and that's a hero, and that's someone whose behavior speaks louder than those words.
Absolutely. I appreciate so much of what you say about the team as you followed them and observed them. And some of the most interesting stuff you have to say, even beyond LeBron James and his teammates, is what you have to say about Coach David Blatt, someone about whom you find all kinds of faults, particularly in the way that he communicated and, you know, certain attitudes that he held. And I appreciate how a lot of what you'd say about Coach Blatt feels very visceral. You are reacting to him as a fan with a certain amount of frustration, and especially in the way in which he sometimes seems at odds with what the city of Cleveland is all about. Do you still feel all of that about Coach Blatt in retrospect?
I do. I've never met Coach Blatt. I handed him a letter once in an attempt to, you know, introduce myself and maybe talk about what was going on with the team and with him while he was coaching and I was working on the book. But, you know, there's a guy who I recognize as a member of my tribe in the cultural and ethnic and religious sense. Also a guy who did his Princeton thesis on one of my favorite authors, Bernard Malamud, and used a line in his thesis that I used as an epigraph for The Whore of Akron. So I felt a sense of kindred spirit, but again, all projection on my part. And I hope for humor's sake, rather than some serious analysis, of watching a guy come into the league with a great deal of fame in the European Basketball League and not even know what he didn't know about the NBA culture, and suddenly having to coach, having to be the boss of LeBron, a guy who was a full-grown man in every sense of the word in a league which is a black league. You know, whatever, you know, debate is to be had about that, the first thing anyone notices about the NBA coming to it afresh is that almost all of the players and many of the coaches are African-American. And you have a guy, you know, went to Princeton, wound up in Israel, and has coached successfully, wildly successfully for many years in Europe and Israel, coming back to this league. He had never held a job in the NBA, and trying to cope with the media, trying to cope with the players, trying to cope with a zeitgeist and a culture he knew nothing about, fascinated me no end, and still does. I'd love to have a conversation with David Blatt about that.
Well, in the meantime, I really do appreciate all that you have to say about him and how he tried to function and keep this ship on course in pursuit of a world championship. Let's finish with one of the compliments you pay to LeBron James back to him as an athlete specifically. We've already talked about him as a man and a citizen. You say at one point, "I have never seen a better athlete on any team in any sport than LeBron James." I suppose an athlete can't be paid a higher compliment than that.
For a team athlete, and the measure of the superstar, you know, the sports writing rubric is he makes the other players better. I really have never seen it, partly because in the NBA there are only five guys on the court, as opposed to 11 in football or the 9 in baseball. But here's a guy, wherever he has gone. He's led Cavaliers teams to the finals that consisted of LeBron and four guys who even the most ardent basketball fans wouldn't really remember that well. And by that measure alone, I really do, a lifetime of watching, you know, the hockey, basketball, you know, football and baseball, I have never seen a player for whom it's more true that he makes everyone around him better.
Hmm. The book again is You're Welcome, Cleveland, How I Helped LeBron James Win a Championship and Save a City, published by HarperCollins, the author Scott Robb. Scott Robb, thank you for writing this terrific book, and thank you for joining me today on the morning show to talk about it. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure, too. Thanks, Greg.
You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD HD. I'm Gregory Berg, and part two of today's program is coming up in just a moment. A look at one of the most iconic ballparks in all of Major League Baseball. Stay with us. Well, if the fans of the Cleveland Cavaliers had to wait a long, long time for a world championship, the fans of Chicago Cubs had to wait even longer. They had to wait more than a century before their hopes and dreams were finally realized. It was actually a few months before that dramatic World Series victory that I recorded the interview that you're about to hear now with Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Ira Burko, stationed for many years with the Chicago Tribune and also someone who's done award-winning writing for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. He's responsible for, I guess, what we would call a really beautiful coffee table book called Wrigley Field, an oral and narrative history of the home of the Chicago Cubs, a book which explores the long history of that iconic ballpark and some of the incredible drama that has unfolded there. I really love this book, and not just because I happen to be a Chicago Cubs fan, but because it's so lovingly crafted, and I especially appreciate the way in which you're not especially shy about weaving in your own personal connection to Chicago, to the game of baseball, and to the Cubs.
Yeah.
Can you just say a word about how personal an experience it was to craft this book, and if it was tricky to decide how much of yourself to sort of imprint in its pages?
Well, to answer the last question first, you know, you do it by feel, and you don't want to have too many eyes, you know, in a book that turns people off. But the fact is that I was born and raised in Chicago, and I spent a good part of my boyhood sneaking into Wrigley Field with my friends from the west side of Chicago. And later I moved to the north side about 3-4 miles from Wrigley Field. But my friends, when I was a boy, 10, 11, 12 years old, we would sneak into Wrigley Field as well as Comiskey Park. But Wrigley Field was always special because it always seemed so beautiful and, oh, so chummy to be around, as opposed to, say, Comiskey Park, which seemed like almost cavernous. And but here you know, Wrigley Field with that great green grass field, which Comiskey Park also had, but Wrigley Field also had the vines on the outfield walls and the red brick retaining wall, which separated
the field from the box seats, and the symmetrical, you know, the bleachers rising up to that great hand-worked scoreboard. And we would sneak into the ball game, and then we would sneak down to the box seats, and we'd be sitting, you know, for a while along the third base boxes, and then the ushers would come throw us out. Then we'd move over to the first base boxes, get thrown out there, and just move around someplace else. And so hardly before I even knew it, I became a credentialed sports writer, the real thing, and covering games at Wrigley Field. And I remember the first time I did it, it was about 27, 28, and I was behind the batting cage in Wrigley Field, and I kept thinking, any moment now, an usher is going to come and grab me by the collar and throw me out.
You felt like an imposter once again.
I felt like a fraud, and exactly. And but it didn't happen, and I spent a certain amount of time, you know, and whenever I could. I had family and parents who are now gone, but at one point, family and friends and, you know, living there. And so I would always, you know, make an effort to when I was writing for the Times. I wrote also for a newspaper enterprise association based in New York, was a national feature syndicate. And I would always make an effort to get to Chicago and write about, you know, some Chicago sports. And but always it was pleasurable always to go to Wrigley Field, except for the press box was quite upstairs in the upper decks, and there were no elevators, so you had to climb, you know, up there. But once you got there and looked out, it was, and you could look out on the ballpark and beyond, and see Lakeshore Drive and see the Lake Michigan and the boats on Lake Michigan, and it almost didn't matter if the Cubs were winning or losing or not. And of course, in the press box, there was the axiom: no cheering in the press box. And so, even though, you know, my heart was with the Cubs, you still had to be an objective reporter, and
I tried. One thing I learned in your book was that the same man designed both Wrigley Field and Comiskey Park, a guy by the name of Zachary Taylor Davis. Tell us what you think he did right in designing Wrigley Field.
Well, somehow he made the stands closer to the field, for one thing. And, you know, but as time went on, the ballpark changed, you know, its integrity a number of times. I think that the White Sox and Comiskey Park wanted it to be, the ballpark to kill, you know, to kill all ballparks. And it was going to be like almost like a castle. And but Chicago, again, the Wrigley Field, was just going to be a ballpark rather than a stadium. And I think those terms, you know, make a difference in perception of the park. And so, you know, it was always more fun, you know, to go to a ball game in Wrigley Field than it was to Comiskey Park. And they eventually tore down Comiskey Park and then built the U.S. Cellular Field across the street, across 35th Street in Chicago, from where the Comiskey Park was. Old Comiskey Park is now a parking lot.
Right. I lived in Chicago in the mid-1980s when I was an apprentice at the Lyric Opera of Chicago, and I lived just a few blocks from Wrigley Field. And, I mean, I wasn't following baseball really whatsoever back then, but I was amazed at one point when I read someplace that Wrigley Field was among the smallest, if not the smallest, place where Major League Baseball was played, because of the fact that it's nestled right in the middle of this regular neighborhood, and because of that, it looms magnificently above its surroundings. So I just couldn't imagine that this was a small place to play baseball. And if you took Wrigley Field, of course, and put it out in the midst of an expanse of concrete, as a lot of stadiums are, you probably wouldn't have the same sense of its size. But I wonder if you felt like that as well. I mean, you know, as a youngster, and of course back then it wasn't small as ballparks went. But I mean, there is a grandeur to it because of the fact that it's right in the middle of that neighborhood.
Right. Well, you know, growing up, and I hadn't gone to other ballparks, you know, maybe in my mind, I hardly even compared it to Comiskey Park. There was just a feel, a sense of those places, and the neighborhood makes a difference, you know. And you get off the elevated train, and you walk through the neighborhood stores to get to the ballpark, and the apartment buildings, and far, a little distance away, the bungalows, the little homes. And somehow there's a sense of being home, and it was one of the smallest. It still is, as far as capacity, seating capacity is concerned, is 41,000 now. But they have to make more money. They've constructed more luxury suites, and that also with the Ricketts family, who bought the ballpark from the Tribune a few years ago, Chicago Tribune Company. They have built. They're going to put in a jumbotron and other kinds of signage, and I don't know how that's going to change the integrity of this architectural gem. Really, you know, I was opposed to putting in lights. I thought that would take away some of the charm of this ballpark.
Mm.
But they put in the lights in a very classy way, I was imagining lights with stanchions like a lot of the old ballparks, like some of these modern parks too. But they put sort of low lying lights around the roof and rooftop, and they're almost elegant, and so it blends in to the rest of the atmosphere of the ballpark. So I was heartened by this.
Right. The years I lived in Chicago were the years that was being hotly debated. And one of the things I remembered was you could walk into a shop or a restaurant in the neighborhood, and complete strangers would easily strike up a conversation about that matter of lights or no lights. And, of course, you saw those no light signs all over the place, and ultimately, of course, the other side won the day. Your book mentions the fact that that among the things done to do this in sort of a classy, respectful, considerate way is the fact that there's a sharp curb on how many night games under the lights actually can be played at Wrigley Field.
Yeah, one of the protests came from a lot of the people living in the neighborhood. And they didn't want, all that congestion at night and horns blowing and noise from the ballpark and then the lights. And they just thought it would create a mess. And I'm not quite sure, you know, that has come to pass. But it's a fait accompli. And they're playing a minimum of night games. The Chicago City Council ordered the Cubs, when they made an agreement to have nights, that they could play only a minimum of night games. But it seems that every year there's one or two more night games than were previously scheduled. So, the Cubs are starting to move in on the way other teams play.
Hmm. One of the things that's striking about the story you tell about the Chicago Cubs, and that's really mostly what this book is about, is the history of this venerable organization,
yeah,
is
the
how
players, of
yes of
the
course
players, yeah.
Is that there are these there are long stretches in which the Cubs seem to be an organization very strongly rooted to the past and to tradition, and then there'll be these other instances in which the Cubs prove to be fairly innovative in things that they try to do, with things like broadcasting games over the radio or telecasting games. I believe your book says at one point that the Cubs were among the first major league teams to do that.
Yeah, and Ladies Day, they innovated Ladies Day, and then women were once a week. Women were maybe on a weekday they were allowed in free. Because mostly the ball games were men were attended the games, and so William Wrigley, the owner of the Cubs at that time, and Bill Veeck, William Veeck Sr., Bill Veeck Jr.'s father, they decided that hey, we have 50% of the population out there let's try to draw them in. And so women started going to games free on Wednesday, but if they wanted to come to games alone or with their spouse or with their boyfriend, on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday, they would have to pay. And but Wednesday, they get in free. And so more and more women started coming to games beyond Ladies' Day, and that was an innovation, and it was picked up around the country. And, of course, you know, Ivy on the Walls, which hasn't been copied. Maybe there's another team that has done that. I don't remember. But, you know, yeah, and the so that there were innovations. And there are people who thought that if you have the games on radio, then people would not come to the games. They'd just sit and listen on radio. And the same thing that happened with television. The feeling was, well, you can't televise games. Well, of course, we know now that even though you broadcast games on radio and broadcast them on television, people still come to the ballpark for the experience of being in a live event. And so the Cubs were in the forefront of this.
Absolutely. This book is loaded with amazing photographs, and actually one of my favorites is a shot taken up in the stands, I think in 1931 or 32, of a ladies' day. And you see these unlikely faces staring into the camera from the stands of Wrigley Field, and
with unlikely hats.
Absolutely, that's it's a great moment in the book. Among one of the things, of course, that's great about this book is that we get to know something about some of the great legends of the game who have played for the Chicago Cubs. But I have to say that one of my favorite moments involving a specific player is when you talk about someone who was a peer, a rival of yours, as you grew up in Chicago playing baseball, a guy by the name of Jim Woods. Nobody now scarcely knows the name because his career in the major leagues was very, very brief indeed.
Right.
But the fact that somebody you knew and had played against had cracked his way into the major leagues, it was a major thrill for you.
Well, and the way he, as you say, cracked in the major leagues was, I played for Sullivan High School, a mediocre player on a good team, and against Lane Tech, and Lane Tech had a star player named Jim Woods, who was a great hitter and great pitcher, and he was my size. I'm 6 feet, you know, I was like 180, and we played in. And I remember we had a game against them in early June of 1957. And then we graduated. He was my year. We were seniors. And immediately at graduation, the Cubs signed Jim Woods. Now, I had played with Jim Woods 3 weeks earlier, against Jim Woods, rather. And the Cubs signed him. Not only did they sign him, but they brought him up to the team immediately and put him on, and he was on the bench, and he was on the roster, and he was in the scoreboard, in the scorecard. You bought a scorecard, you see Jim Woods' number, whatever his number was, and here was a guy I'd just been playing with, and suddenly he's a major leaguer. And it turned out that he only got into two games at the end of the season, and both as a pinch runner, and then they traded him to the Phillies, and he had a short career with the Phillies. Highlighted with he had three home runs, but highlighted by hitting a double off Sandy Koufax in the Dodgers in the Coliseum in Los Angeles, and they had a great big they had a short left field fence, but they had a 42-foot screen to make it seem like the left field was farther than it really was, and Jim Woods hit near the top of the screen, so he really. It would have been a home run, but he crushed Sandy Koufax with hitting a double, and that was the highlight of his career. And somehow I identified with all this, you know, because here was a guy I played against, actually in basketball too. We played against each other in Chicago Public League basketball, but it was a thrill for us. And then a bunch of us were in a car driving, and we were listening to Cub game, and Jim Woods is now a pinch running. For the Cubs, oh my God! We're in the car. We're screaming and hollering. It was great.
You seem to have a fairly optimistic view of the future in terms of the game of baseball and young people. I mean, we hear a lot, think a lot about other sports sort of crowding in and grabbing more and more young athletes and more of their focus. But you don't particularly see that, and you see a very bright future for the game of baseball when we look at young people across the country.
Right. Well, you know, the little leagues are still popular, and they're still young kids who are better at baseball, you know, talented kids who are better at baseball or like baseball more than they do basketball or football or even tennis. But that's America. That's one thing. But also the Latin countries, you know, I mean, the Dominican Republic, even Venezuela. I mean, we get Puerto Rico. We get players from all these places, and they're all wonderful players. Look at all the Ramirez's and the Rodriguez's and the Gonzalez's, you know, who are playing in Major League Baseball and playing it so well, and you know, it's exciting, and they're great, and I think that that baseball definitely has a future, and also it's just an interesting game, and it's just it's a fun game to watch once you understand the game. You know, so many people say, it's boring, it's long, and everything. Well, not if you understand it, you know, and not if you care about it, and then get to know the players, you know, and have a sense of who they are and what their stories are. It's an enduring sport, and even though the owners sometimes are, you know, seem to be intent on ruining the game with their lockouts or whatever, it endures, and it has endured, and I don't know, I still love it.
Mm-hmm. As do I, and I love Wrigley Field. I've actually only been there twice, once to sing the national anthem in a game in 2001, and then a couple of years later, a game where infamously Sammy Sosa in hitting the ball had his bat shatter, and it proved to be full of cork. He was ejected for the rest of the game, and so we'd witnessed a bit of unexpected drama in that beautiful place where so much drama has played out over the years.
Well, you know what Sammy said about that? It reminded me, and I wrote a column about it in the Times, about it was reminiscent of a song, I didn't know the gun was loaded, and I'm so sorry, my friend. I didn't know the gun was loaded. I'll never ever shoot you again. Something he didn't know. He said he didn't know that the bat was corked. You know. So and then he used a cork bat in batting practice to hit balls farther, just for entertainment value. And then he took the wrong bat from the bat rack. Well, yes, Sammy, of course. You know.
Well, one of many intriguing figures we read about, and again, the book is a handsome book with all kinds of amazing photographs that bring this long history of the Chicago Cubs thrillingly to life. The book, again, is called Wrigley Field, An Oral and Narrative History of the Home of the Chicago Cubs, published by Stuart Taborian Chang and the author Ira Burko. We should mention that there's a really lovely foreword to the book by former Cubs pitcher Kerry Wood, in which he speaks so beautifully and sincerely about his time with the Cubs and his love of Wrigley Field. There's a preface by former U.S. Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens, who tells a touching story about throwing out the first pitch at the age of 85.
Right.
And there's even...
he was a Cub fan. He's been a Cub fan. He's from Chicago, and he's been a Cub fan since he was 7 years old in 1927.
And we even have a few words from White Sox fan President Barack Obama. All that and more in this intriguing book called Wrigley Field. Ira Burko, thank you so much for putting this book together and for joining me today on the morning show to talk about it. I've enjoyed this.
My pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
And a reminder, support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Frank Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and morning show co-host.